People in other parts of the country tend to draw sharp breaths when they see the natural beauty here where we live. And it is impressive. Tall mountains and big trees and clean, clear rivers. Well, up to a point. Even rivers that look pretty and flow through pretty places can still miss water quality guidelines. And there are a few of those in our region. The Eel River in Humboldt County is one that needs a little love, and it is getting it from the Eel River Recovery Project, which itself got some love in the form of a grant from the state of California. Two guests join us. Patrick Higgins is the Eel River Recovery Project Managing Director. Patrick, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Dan Marr is with us as well. He is from High Tide Permaculture and is working as a land management consultant for the Eel River Recovery Project. Dan, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Pat, can you give us the history lesson on the recovery project and what some of the major issues with the eel are?
Sure. The Eel River Recovery Project is a grassroots group that was born in 2011. I had studied the Eel River for Friends of Eel, and had actually found that instead of heading towards extinction, that false Chinook were actually rebounding considerably. And in 2010, to much to my surprise, there was 10 to 30,000 Chinook salmon in the Eel River Basin. And then at the same time, the river was experiencing toxic algae problems where neurotoxins could take out a dog within 15 minutes of frolicking in the edges. And
we're talking cyanobacteria and that kind of
that
stuff?
That is cyanobacteria, and different than the ones in the Klamath that attack the liver. These are neurotoxic and therefore much more pernicious in terms of public health and much more obvious in terms of their effects. So we convened public meetings. The public said, great about the Chinook. Let's continue to monitor. We thought they were going extinct. But also, let's do something about this toxic algae. Then also there was a concern over the loss of flow in the river as a result of quasi-legalization of marijuana. So we began to test whether or not there were problems with flow depletion through the use of temperature. And temperature can give you an indication of flow because lesser volume and longer transit time lead to higher temperature. But in 2012, when we kicked it off with small grants from Rose and Patagonia, we found, in fact, that, you know, it was like the Dylan phrase, you don't need a weatherman to know if the wind blows. Creeks were drying up. Outlet Creek, 10 Mile Creek, Tomkai Creek, very large vital tributaries of the Eel were losing surface flow in years that were not dry. And then now we've had 3 years of drought out of the range of norm, probably indicative of a change in ocean and climate conditions in a short-term cycle called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation Cycle. That's why we're getting the Nino. That's why you're getting the thunderstorms, actually. We want to build into the culture of the eel the ability to take its pulse, to measure its temperature, to otherwise do citizen monitoring that is scientifically valid, and then we can understand better how the ecosystem is trending. Is it fishable, swimmable, and drinkable as guaranteed by the Clean Water Act? And then if it's not, can our neighbors work together in order to forge a solution? And that's where Dan Marr on the phone here, High Tide Permaculture, comes in spades. And I will yield the floor considerably to Dan because of his expertise in that regard. We worked for 2.5 years to finally open a grant with the State Water Resources Control Board. It's actually from their cleanup and abatement funds, which mostly target on-site remediation of very damaged areas because of the number of infractions and the assets in that fund because of the marijuana culture and problems and fines. We're tapping those funds to do something different, and that is to proactively.
Hard to say before 9 in the morning, I know.
Yeah, well, you know, proactively engage people to conserve water and to reduce nutrient influx, because our hypotheses are both that the eel's flow is being depleted, but also that the nutrients are stimulating the algae. And the state of California's North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board has these studies called TMDLs, where the eel's too hot. And
total maximum daily loads.
Yeah, and so those studies have been concluded, and our monitoring actually helps them with implementation. And so their staff highly values our data. We go out to different places in the hills, and the hills are vast in the eel, and we help people understand their place, and then they tell us their story, and we put together their eyewitness with our science, and it's quite powerful. And in aggregate, the eel is a paradox because it's in recovery. It's got more Chinook salmon than since the 50s. We put people in the water to count them, and they run into a school of 500. It's a life experience they don't forget. We're also finding the toxic algae. We documented last year from an airplane that the river went dry in its lower reaches in Fortuna. But at the same time that it was 100 degrees and the river approaches dry this year, I went into 5 spots in the last 2 weeks where it's so cold it'd give you a headache, and there was steelhead all over the place. So the eel is a potentially resilient ecosystem. But the big question right now and on everyone's mind is, can we make the cannabis industry, and I don't like to call it an industry, let's call it a cottage industry maybe, kind of wishful thinking maybe, but the scale has to be appropriate so that it's okay for the animals and for the river. And if we do that, then we will be truly rich going forward. And we're on the cusp of that, and we're working towards that. And so thank you for that very generous opportunity to introduce people to the Recovery Project, eelriverrecovery.org online. And we also have a Facebook page. And so we feel privileged to have such a engaged community. And we think that the eel, more people in the eel care about it than in other basins in California, and that there's less vested large power and money obstructing us from solutions. And now, you know, the question is, can we organize ourselves? And that's what we try to aid.
Patrick Higgins and Dan Maher are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. Patrick is the Eel River Recovery Project Managing Director. Dan from High Tide Permaculture is a land management consultant for the project. You can join us with your questions and comments about river recovery generally, the Eel River specifically, 800-838-3760 around the region, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. For either one of you, you did mention 3 different creeks, Patrick, and how seriously are those being depleted? In some cases, are they delivering no water to the main stem of the eel?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Tom Kite Creek comes into the eel just below the Potter Valley Project, constructed in 1922 and diverting water from the eel to the Russian. And when the dam was built, all the fish that couldn't go to the Snowy Mountain Wilderness piled into Tom Kite. And it's, I have verbal accounts from the 30s, and it must have been a miracle to behold. In the mid-80s, it still had 3,000 to 5,000 Chinook, and lately it's got dozens to hundreds and rarely runs on the surface. 10 Mile Creek goes through Laytonville, and it still gets as many or more Chinook salmon than the South Fork to its west, which actually comes out of a preserve. But it is very, very heavily developed at this point in terms of the culture, lots of ponds. And so when I was in there the other day, people could go to Eel River Recovery on YouTube and see a swarm of brown catfish moving along the edge of a pool that had been isolated by the depletion of flow. So 10 Mile still seasonally contributes flow to the main eel, but it also contributes things like brown bullhead from the Mississippi River, green sunfish that come out of the ponds. And I just found what UC Berkeley, we have a very close relationship with UC Angelo Preserve in the Upper South Fork, and they found below 10 Mile swamp crayfish, the red swamp crayfish, and I found a dead one the other day. So, you know, that 10 Mile has huge potential recovery for recovery, but it also at present presents the highest risk in the eel for aquatic invasive species. And then Outlet is a giant creek that people drive through in Willits. They don't understand. They're in the eel. It's, 150 miles from Fortuna where the river comes out. But the salmon still run above Willits into the headwater creeks there. And Outlet Creek is a vital Chinook salmon spawning habitat, including in its lower reaches below 101 down to the eel. And so seasonally, it's the salmon's world, and the Chinook get out of there quick, so they thrive. But the ones that need a river that persists all summer long and remains cold are vexed in those water bodies. And, you know, there's exceptions to everything. There's cold, hidden little tribs to Outlet Creek, I'm sure, where the trout persist And every time we think they're about ready to go extinct, I look somewhere and see a ton of them. And they know where everything is because they've evolved for millions of years. But right now, if you shut off the three main eel tribs in Mendocino County, the southern portion of the eel, you can't expect the lower eel to behave in the range norm.
It just doesn't do that. So, Dan Maher, I want to come to you and just give us an idea what some of the attributes of the Eel River are that make it a challenge to work with, or B make it easier that it, in ways that it helps itself.
Well, the Eel, as Pat had pointed out, is a massive river basin, and it covers multiple counties. And a lot of the portions of it are extremely remote to get to. But as you know, as the Eel River Recovery Project has been doing work and other nonprofits and community groups, access has become a little bit more open in terms of people being willing to allow monitoring to come in, or now with the grant having us come in and do on-site technical assistance in regards to water conservation and pollution prevention.
Let's talk about the citizen monitoring and how that works into what's going on here. How many people do you expect to do it, and what sorts of things will they be monitoring?
Actually, the Recovery Project has been doing water temperature monitoring now since 2012, and this year will be expanded to over 100 locations in cooperation with University of California, Berkeley Angelo Preserve. We'll probably have 100 and a quarter out there, and so that's a very useful and vital exercise. We have cyanotoxin sensors that are analyzed by the University of California at Santa Cruz in cooperation with UC Berkeley, and Keith Boma-Gregson of UC Berkeley has led us in this endeavor, and in 2013 he put out 8, last year he put out 10, and this year we have about, I think it's 12 locations. It's quite a three-ring circus, but we're trying to figure out where is the eel toxic? And we're finding that it's primarily in the South Fork. And so that's a benefit to Humboldt County Public Health. That's, otherwise we're flying blind. We're also communicating in Mendocino County where we're finding cyanotoxins in the South Fork there. We do fall Chinook dives. And if anybody is in our listening audience in Humboldt County that likes to slap on a wetsuit and see amazing things underwater, sometimes chilly, they can call me at 223-7200, and we have counted as many as 8,000 Chinook salmon in 2 days in the lower Eel in 2012. And then our volunteers upstream counted 150 salmon an hour at Alder Point for a day and a half twice in 2012. There was probably 50,000 animals in the basin, and that creates high excitement. However, there is a pike minnow, formerly called the squawfish, introduced into the Eel in 1979, tends to consume salmonids, that is salmon and steelhead, the things which we love, and so we will be counting them with the intent ultimately of helping to manage them so that they don't eat all the fish that we like. And then we're doing amphibians with Dr. Sarah Kupferberg, and you can judge the health of the Eel River and its various tributaries by the number of Yellow Lake frog eggs. They look like a ball of caviar about the size of a golf ball. In 10 days, they're flipping all over in the creek, and in a couple of weeks, they're jumping all over the bank. And you can count them really easily when they're eggs. So we're going to do that every April and try to expand that throughout the Eel. While yellow-leg frogs and the western pond turtle, another good indicator species, are going sideways and down in the rest of California, pesticides, air pollution, more desiccation, and in the Eel, systematic agricultural desiccation. In the Eel, the yellow-leg frogs and the western pond turtle abound. And so even in the drought, the Eel is drought-adapted. So some things thrive. Riverbanks rebuild. Our rivers get a chance to recover from past floods. So, you know, the Eel, if we work with nature in the Eel, we've got tremendous potential. But if we don't have data to understand it and to answer our questions about it, then we're flying blind. And so the science is our guide. The citizens trust the science that they generate. Their neighbors trust it. So then they can go forward on resolving the problems that emerge. But we never assign blame. Scientific truth, no judgment. Engage, enlighten, and empower under the presumption if they had better information, they do the right thing.
So you really can get a chance to monitor the vital signs of the river, as it were, on a pretty much a real-time basis now.
Yeah, well, real-time implies that our gauges could be read out instantaneously, and instead, at the end of the season, we have hugely rich data sets from each location. We've got, you know, every 30 minutes, we take a temperature point, and so it's a very powerful tool. We hope to affix these stations permanently in portions of the eel that are stable, not all are, and that way we can get temperatures in the winter, and we're feeding these data both to the North Coast Regional Board and to the Forest Service, which is doing a western climate study. And it turns out that winter cold temperatures are as important as summer warm temperatures for understanding climate change.
We are talking about the Eel River Recovery Project with Patrick Higgins and Dan Maher. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Casey in Jackson County. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. I've noticed for the past, it's the third season now already, this invasive noxious weed known as poison hemlock. And it seems to be exponentiating, and at this point, I found it 10 miles in the forest. And I was wondering if that might affect wildlife and what could be done about it, because I've talked with the police, the fire department, city council, the planning commission. I even tried to talk to the president of the United States, and nobody wants anything to do with any of it. And I was wondering, is that a problem?
Let's find out. Thanks for that, KC. Dan, what do you know about poison hemlock?
Well, I don't know the specifics on it in terms of wildlife, but like any invasive plant, you know, they tend to move in areas of disturbance. So as we go in and, you know, take part in certain activities and disturb soil and land, we have to also be mindful of, you know, us being responsible for any change we create. Soil management is a really big deal, especially in river basins, because as soon as we disturb soil, then we open it up not only to invasives, but also to the potential for discharge. And surface discharge is a big deal when we talk about rivers and salmonids. Roads being, you know, the largest discharger of sediment into waterways. So being very mindful of all of our activities when we disturb soil to make sure that, you know, we're employing best management practices in terms of erosion control, but also are we revegetating those areas to make sure that we don't have a problem with either discharge or invasives coming in and taking over.
Which raises the question then about the marijuana cultivation that has impacted the eel and many other streams in California. If it were to stop today, is there a lot of remediation that would have to be done to put those places back into a natural area? Could they still be affecting the river for years, even if marijuana growing stopped dead?
Yes, but I also want to point out that we're also looking at a legacy of forest management and logging practices prior to, you know, the cannabis cultivation that's taking place now on a much larger scale. So, you know, there's been a lot of disturbance in terms of roads and soil and forests for many, many, many years. So recovery is going to be a process that's going to take more than the number of years of disturbance that we've experienced in those regions.
I want to intercede here just for a second, and that is to say that the small back of the landers who still exist out there and grow organically with mycelium and biodynamic soils and thin from below so their house doesn't burn up, their gardens are not that visible on Google Earth, and if you chop down their garden, all it would do is deprive them of their cash flow, and there is no need for remediation because they are in harmony with nature. And if they can become the model of our culture, then. Here's what happened. Essentially, at first it was clandestine. The people that came back to the land were wanting to get out of the city. God's in nature, small is beautiful. Then it's quasi-legal in 95. Then about 10 years later, our sheriff goes, there's so many out there, we can't control it. So what's that say? Everybody could come here and nobody's going to get you. And so we have a lot of people who've come in late. They don't have an owner's manual, and that's the people that you see with the chopped down mountaintop removal. And, you know, and they're defying gravity, and they're doing push-up berms in creeks, but it's not necessarily the normal behavior. And so it's much more nuanced than, you know, all of them are bad and it all needs to be eradicated. But, yeah, those sites that that the North Coast Regional Board, for instance, is citing for cleanup and abatement, they present extreme risk when there's intense rainfall.
All right, so I was going to ask about the interaction of what you're doing at the Eel River Recovery Project with the efforts of the state water control boards to at least point out to some of the marijuana growers you don't have the right to the water you've been using. Do you work with that alongside that, or is this sort of going on while you're doing your thing?
Well, we do not get involved in the permitting questions. Although we are funded by the state board, and some, you know, who are not really discerning might say, oh, you work for them. And so, therefore, you are an arm of them. But, you know, everything about our visits is confidential. The State Water Board Water Rights Division has sway over water rights. They are asking people in the basin to sign up for their water rights. There haven't been a lot of other initiatives in California like this from the State Board, by the way. And then also the North Coast Regional Board, much to their credit, is trying to make the industry trend towards legitimacy, so they have a pollution permit for cannabis culture called a waiver of waste discharge. And we want to make sure that people understand that. Their staff presented our meetings when we're meeting with the public, and we want to let people know what it might be like for them to conform to such permits in the event that they wanted to.
All right, this is the Eel River Recovery Project we're talking about. Patrick Higgins is the managing director. Dan Marr is with High Tide Permaculture and a land management consultant for the project. Thank you both for joining us today, and best of luck.
Thank you.
This has been a privilege. I hope maybe we could do it again and give you a progress report.
We look forward to it. This is the Jefferson Exchange, back in 1 minute.